Okay, I think we're ready to start. Hello, everybody, and thanks for coming this afternoon. I hope you enjoyed your lunch. And so it's my pleasure to introduce our afternoon panel, our first one of the afternoon on getting the data approaches to managing personal data. Our moderator today will be Professor Sandy Pentland. Sandy helped create and direct MIT's Media Lab and the Media Lab Asia and the Center for Future Health. He chairs the World Economic Forum Data-Driven Development Council and is the Academic Director to the Data Pop Alliance. And is a member of the advisory boards for Google, Nissan, Telefonica, the United Nations Secretary General, Monument Capital, and Minerva Schools. So please take it away, Sandy.
So hope you have an interesting time here. We have a great set of panelists in no particular order. Stephen Wolford, right, from Trulio. Don Taylor from Benefit Focus. Paolo Pilazzoli, okay, got that right, from Broadridge, and Brigham High from Decision Resources. And what we're going to do here is I'm going to pontificate for a minute or three, and then each of these gentlemen who are actually doing things are going to talk for 5, 6, 7 minutes, something like that, and then we'll have questions, and you can throw tomatoes if you have tomatoes. Don't throw anything hard. We'll let them talk among themselves a little bit, but then open it up, okay? The topic today is, what are you doing, right? Around personal data, managing it. Everybody talks about big data, making enterprises work better. Probably half the corporations I talk to are also trying to get into the data business, so selling insights to other corporations.
Is your microphone on?
I don't know. Suppose it should be, but is this better?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Oh my gosh, now I have the big voice. Okay, which is good because I have a little bit of a cold. My voice is okay. So the management of personal data is, of course, all of a sudden a big issue, and it's discussed by regulators. There's a lot of intense scrutiny about this. Over the last 6, 7 years, I've run a group at Davos, which is the lead regulators for the US, the EU, China, places like that, and CEOs of major multinationals talking about this. And the conclusions about that are ways of clarifying who owns this data and what can you do with it. And the resolution is around we have to begin involving the customer or the citizen much more in what happens with the data. They own the data. In essence, you can think of it as they give you a license to the data, but you should own the aggregate data, right, when you put things together. And so clarifying that is still an open discussion, but more and more it's moving towards that sort of world. One of the things I think is most interesting in making this happen is not just pressure from the regulators. So data protection acts in Europe and the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights here and all the declarations by the Federal Trade Commission. But the realization that this personal data is not only a resource to the company, but it's a major liability should you lose it or mistreat it in some way. And that architectures that are good for privacy may also be good for security. And in particular, there's a notion which I like and have been sort of pushing, which is that when you hold personal data, when you hold any sort of sensitive data, you want to have it in a heterogeneous and distributed way. For instance, when the Snowden affair came out, the major thing that the head of the NSA said was, the first mistake we made was sticking all that data in one location. And it's true. When you make a honeypot like that, people will attack it and they will get through, whether through insiders or through outside attack. So the architecture that's good for security turns out to also be something that's very good for handling the issues of privacy. And that, I think, is a really interesting insight because when you go to the board and you say, I need all this money to be able to handle personal data, it's nice to be able to also say that this is a security solution also, and we're doing risk management generally for the enterprise, not just privacy. And I think that turns it in from a nice-to-have to a must-have sort of a thing. So I've said my little piece. Why don't we just go down the line here? Is that okay?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay, so why don't you start, Brigham?
Great. Thanks, Sandy, and thanks for having me. It's a great topic, very prescient. By way of background, I'm Chief Data Officer at Decision Resources Group. We are an information company that advises our health partners, everybody from pharma to payers to hospitals and IDNs. As a result of that, we buy patient-level claims data and integrate it, which is something that is almost a constant process at this point. So from my seat, I look at this issue and sort of see it two ways. One, I'm looking to protect my organization as we acquire and have to deal with this data and have to adhere to regulations like HIPAA and GINA to the extent that that's applicable. But also, as an analytics lead, it's value, you know, we're being put to the test in healthcare to figure out how to make sense of this data, create value from it, and constantly balancing that issue of sort of security and privacy versus the power that can come from analyzing that combined data. As I sort of, look at sort of what's happening right now, the things that we're paying attention to are, I'd say, on the regulatory side. I think HIPAA, as originally conceived, is sort of ironically at odds with meaningful use and the parts of Obamacare that exist. We're being asked to move in Obamacare to measure cost and quality, but the system around HIPAA requires that information to be kept so separate and aggregate that sometimes that's a difficult thing to do. I know our hospital partners really struggle with that. They can look within their organization, but they have a really hard time benchmarking, and we know all the cross-compatibility issues that exist in healthcare. So there's that. I'm not to say that HIPAA is a bad thing. It's a conflict that exists in trying to analyze and benchmark while also trying to keep people's privacy. I think the other big wave is digital health, something that, the Apple Watch out, we start to talk about, the growth in applications, the collection of personal data that may actually be health data through your cell phone or your wristwatch, and what that means. And I think, again, that challenges the issue of privacy as we start to connect those data sets. The concepts of metadata and sort of statistical inference of identifying individuals through that type of data is going to create, I think, a real challenge around that. And our goal should be, of course, to protect the issues of the individuals and sort of a do no harm mentality, but at the same time not dealing with the real concept of the challenge of connectivity and privacy, I think, is one we're going to have to face down. So that's where I sit on this one.
Great.
Very good, thanks. My name is Steve Bufford. I'm one of the founders of a company based in San Francisco. Or actually, it's a Canadian company based in San Francisco. It's a venture-backed called Trilio. And we started with trying to solve, about 3 years ago, the internet's oldest problem, being known when you want to be online. So very simple problem from the top, but very, very hard to solve in context of a discussion like this when it comes to all the information out there about you. So we built this platform called Global Gateway, which its original kind of purpose was to do just that. Build a trust layer into the web and fuel a whole bunch of businesses with information about you when you want to share it with them. Not to create a new set of information about you, but to leverage companies and relationships that you have to prove who you are when you want to prove who you are. So we started off, obviously, in the US. Very, very quickly, most of our customers had a global use case. So we had to figure out from a regulatory standpoint, when we started handling information about you, how could we do that? And how could we do that at global scale? So one of the items that Sandy was talking about that we quickly learned about at a young startup was this notion of user as owner of their own information. This is actually quite new in terms of a lot of the companies that have information about us. Most of them, even social networks, believe they own that information about you, regardless of what you think. And so often with those big 800-pound gorillas, it's very, very difficult to argue that for startups or obviously any company. But luckily, folks in government really very quickly started to adopt that type of strategy around regulation. So Sandy mentioned acts like DPA in Canada. There's, you know, one called Bill C-6, which in the U.S. a whole bunch of them around things like credit reporting and personal information. But without getting down to the weeds, again, we had to solve for a much simpler use case: is how do we do this, solve this problem on the web across multiple jurisdictions? So not just for U.S. citizens or Europeans or Canadians. And again, user as owner was really where we started. And so we used technology to link a whole bunch of information about people around the world. And so today, our platform covers about 4 billion consumers. I believe I've been in the data business. This is my fourth startup for my entire career. And I believe we're the largest data aggregator in terms of what the world would know as an aggregator that's ever existed. Although in 2015, there's no aggregation. So that data actually stays with the repositories where it's been collected and then linked. And I think that that's the future, because when you assemble information about people in that way and position the user as the owner of that information, so again, wanting to share it when they want to, that's a new type of aggregation. It's you know, positioning the consumer to say yes for this particular purpose of knowing something about me, it's okay, and you can go to this source of information about me, do some analytics over there. Again, don't bring it all into one honeypot. Do some analytics over there so you can figure out who I am. And we found that this has scaled really, really well. In fact, for a young startup with about $10 million in funding, we now have access to data from over 15 governments around the world, so including China, of all places. Things like the citizenship files for China are now available electronically to access. And so one of the use cases that we tried to solve around knowing who you are online was identity verification for the purposes of financial transactions. So a more benevolent use case for me, in particular as one of the founders, was to include more of the emerging markets in first world financial services. That's a huge, huge step for those folks. And one of the biggest things that has always been a challenge for first world FIs is building trust with those consumers. Not knowing anything about people in emerging markets is probably the single biggest limitation to lending money to them, for instance, so they can start a business like you take for granted. So going after that use case is actually really built very quickly a very profitable large business for us as a secondary and growing concern for us. You know, this notion of putting the user in the middle and saying, yes, you can share my information for our 400 plus enterprise customers, and then linking their data all together and sharing it as part of an ecosystem is exactly where I think the industry is going to head. I think that in a post-Snowden era, as Sandy identified, this idea of mass aggregation for those of the companies that have managed to do that in the past, I think is over. I've sold two of my companies to credit bureaus over the years, and I would never want to try and build another one of those companies today. Yeah, I believe it's impossible. But instead, building an identity bureau, which is what, you know, we're trying to build, is all about simply putting you in front, making sure you control the interaction with companies, and linking all the information. There's so much information about us out there, but making it available for you to leverage online is really what it's about. And I think that that's our mission and what I'll be talking mostly about today.
Great. Good. All right. Thank you. My name is Don Taylor. I'm Chief Technology Officer at Benefit Focus. And Benefit Focus is we're a cloud-based benefits marketplace solution. And what that means is that our customers are large insurance carriers, large brokers, and large employers. And basically what we do is we consolidate. Well, what's really happened over the last several years, obviously these last couple of years, there's been massive disruption in the insurance industry. We started as an enrollment company where we were basically just taking the paper out of the process. So a large employer, they would sign up, say, a Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina. We would manage that enrollment process electronically. Then we would send EDI transactions to all of the various carriers. And what has happened over the last couple of years is that we're seeing this major shift towards consumerism, which is partly being driven by the government and us trying to drive down costs and fix that situation. But then there's also just the cost of the employers, and the employers are also extremely focused on figuring out how to drive down the cost. So
if you look back at like what happened with pension plans, how they all of a sudden we saw 401ks, and then over X number of years, the 401k really became the mechanism, and we became the owners of the 401k rather than an owner of a pension plan. And as a result, we got smarter on how to invest our money, what funds were available, why should I put money here versus there. Well, I believe, and we believe, the same thing's really happening with healthcare at large, where I'm going to be, if I'm an employer, there's a thing called defined contribution. So we're going to start seeing companies giving you X amount of dollars per month and giving you the ability to make decisions on what benefits to buy for your family, ultimately shifting to a point where, you know, it's a retention factor. I don't think employers will quit giving you that money, just like they don't, like they do on matching 401ks, but it'll become more and more our responsibility to make the right decisions for our family. So what we've been doing over the years, and what's really become our mission, is to use all of this data, which, you know, I'll talk about the challenges with that in a minute, but to use all of that data to number one, help the carriers make better decisions on how to bundle products, how to sell products most effectively into their employer bases. So our marketplaces and private exchanges today produce a set of analytics that help an employer make, I mean, I'm sorry, a carrier make the best decisions on how to deploy product. And then the employers themselves are also looking at the claims utilization and a lot of the analytics that are coming out of how I'm actually consuming the healthcare and what is it costing me, and they're using those analytics to make decisions on what plans to offer me or ultimately put together into a private exchange. And then there's the consumer, who is all of us, who's now getting to a point where we have a lot more responsibility in the process. So we're using a lot of the data and analytics out of the platform as an example for recommendation, making appropriate recommendations to help me better protect myself and my family. And the interesting thing that's been happening from a privacy perspective that I've seen, I would agree that HIPAA is probably going to need some reworking here soon, because traditionally the carrier owned the claims data, which would be, I go to the doctor, I get some medicine, I have some x-rays, all that manifests itself through a claims record, which is really the most accurate personal health snapshot that you would have. So if you were going to build a personal health record, ideally you'd want to do it, use claims data as the foundation for that, because it would require so much less input into the system. And what has begun happening now is that the employer actually can use the claims data, and the employer can look at my family and my utilization and know every single thing that I'm consuming from a healthcare perspective. But me as a head of household, I cannot look at claims data of my 16-year-old because there's a privacy issue there. So what I see happening is over the next X number of years, the consumer, who's going to really become the driver in this entire process, will begin to force that ownership of the data. And I agree wholeheartedly that it comes down to, if I'm going to be the keeper of this data, which is, should be distributed, I need to provide transparency to the people whose data I have. I need to instill trust. So I certainly, you know, building that architecture of security and privacy is hugely important. And then I also have to provide value back to the consumer with that data. And if I combine all of those, then most likely the consumer will take ownership of that data, and it will really turn that entire process upside down. So.
Great. Paolo Pellizzoli, I work for Broadridge Financial. We do a lot of the processing for transactions that come through the big banks, broker-dealers worldwide. Just to put it in context, we have very similar problems to healthcare, where jurisdictions and regulation are constantly changing. They've gone up over 700% since 2008. And we don't see that slowing down. We, in fact, see many more geographies starting to go through and adopt the U.S. view on regulation. Part of to put it in context, we've been processing transactions for over 50 years. So we have a lot of history as to, most of you here have probably done some kind of financial transaction. I'd probably say with around a 90% accuracy that we know what that transaction was, who you did it with, and how profitable it was. Through your life, you'll have gone through multiple financial institutions, and those institutions own that snippet of time that they actually went through and were your advisor, your broker, or whoever it might be. But you own your entire lifespan as an investor. So also regulation, once we've gone through and put the information back to those institutions, it's very difficult to kind of put that genie back in the bottle, right? Any kind of derivative data product that's out there that was already transmitted where regulation didn't go through and say you're not supposed to do that, that's already out there. So what we start looking at is when we look at big data, we come in two different forms. One is structured. It's easier to go through and secure structured information. Unstructured information is still kind of the Wild West. So we're looking at how do we now take jurisdictions or data sovereignty across multiple, not just geographies, but institutions. And when you ask a question across them, how do we go through and give you the appropriate entitlement, the appropriate entitlement rather than a blended one which violates both jurisdictions. So when we start talking about ontologies and redacting information after the question had gone through an already aggregated information, that is one of the big challenges in the finance industry. And in that challenge, we're also starting to go through and question whether the regulators actually do have rights to see that aggregated information or whether they can just go through and see trends. If they see a trend that looks suspicious, they can go to the two institutions that were trading between each other, provide the proof, and then go through, then go through into an arbitration or potentially an electronic subpoena for people to decrypt the information and basically give them their appropriate piece. Thank you, I appreciate that. Sorry, it's a lot of travel recently. But we are also going through and talking to regulators in this country and other countries. On top of this, once we start dealing with those entitlements, it's kind of a word that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But effectively, your access rights. Once those access rights are merged, once they're merged, there is also another thing where different countries have treaties with us, and those treaties can go through and say you've got a certain amount of leeway. So I do think that this is a trend. I do agree with Sandy's point as to don't bring it to a central honeypot. There are quite a few different reasons beyond the central, place to attack. But on top of that, I think that over the next 5 years, you're going to start seeing, and five may be optimistic on my part, I think it's probably longer than that. How do you secure artifacts that don't have natural security to them? And, just ask your kids how many times they've gone through and downloaded an app and accepted all of the permissions that they want. Again, very difficult to unlearn a lot of that information as to whose contacts, what you've done. You can derive an awful lot of information out of that, and that's already out there. So, not to scare anybody, but we're trying to go through and make sure that your financial information, similar to your healthcare information, does start getting under a little bit more control.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask one or two questions and then I'll open it up to the audience here. So the first question I wanted to ask is about, I would think of it as architecture. How are you configuring things to be able to deal with these sorts of challenges? And maybe just to take your point one step further, I know one of the effects that the Snowden revelations had is that increasingly countries are requiring that data generated by their citizens stay within the borders of the country. And that makes for assembling a record of an entire person's life really difficult. So how are you dealing with this sort of new way of looking at things? No particular order, whoever wants to go first.
Okay.
I thought you mentioned a couple of great things. I'll steal one of your points from our preamble. So first of all, structurally, whenever we get the opportunity, we are paying third parties. I actually think there's business models to de-identify, actually to de-risk ourselves. And that's, you know, more common potentially in healthcare because of the regulation. I mean, RGC does not want any, you know, personal data floating around in our service that doesn't have to be there. So we are de-identifying. That creates a challenge for us in analysis, of course. But there are cool business models emerging whereby you can, you know, basically form partnerships that define how aggregation is done and where things are stored, what I can access. I think the second thing is that from a pure sort of IT infrastructure, IT architecture perspective, we are, again, keeping things, we decided to keep things very siloed, but create the map, and you mentioned ontologies, Paolo. I think that's really a key part of this. You know, the interoperability of data sets can be defined through those ontologies, through the business logic of them, and you can securitize those separate portions of things and authorize not only the data stacks themselves, but what can be combined. And I think that's an emerging maybe best practice as I'm seeing it. You know, pretty much everywhere in healthcare. Well, everybody in healthcare that has sophisticated IT, that's not necessarily the case everywhere. So I think that's a key principle.
Can I just poke one thing at that?
Yeah.
So this spring we published a paper showing that for most types of data, if you could give me 3 or 4 outside points, we could re-identify things. And that was the major technical citation in the recent court decision against the National Security Agency, right?
Yeah.
So you said de-identify data, right. And my little, you know, antenna goes up and says,
let's talk about HIPAA. Yeah, let's talk about HIPAA, right? I mean, the statistical de-identification standards of HIPAA are pretty well established. But, you know, it's something on the order of like, okay, well, I need to de-identify everybody in this 3-digit zip code. And I can store that they had rheumatoid arthritis and that they went to a doctor on a certain day. And in and of the data set itself, that's not enough to re-identify the person. But with a Facebook API, is it? I mean, maybe, if you know the temporality. So I would agree with you whether or not that's actually private. But that gets back to the HIPAA standards, which is what we're measuring ourselves against at the moment.
It's like talking to the EU's chief regulator.
Yeah.
It wouldn't pass snuff there because, it's de-identified without any side information, but it just takes a little bit of side information.
Very much.
And the point is that's in general.
Yeah.
Right? It's not just specific cases. It's in general.
You know, personally, this is a completely personal statement. I drift towards, I don't think I believe this absolutely, but I drift towards like the data singularity in some ways. It's like my genome's online, I'm part of the 1,000 genome thing, you can look my stuff up, I publish my Google Health records, bring it on insurance companies. Like I just think there's no chance that we can ever secure it. I'd rather just be part of the early study that helps me, I guess. So that's not to say that's our policy, but personally it gets to feel that way sometimes.
Yeah.
The architecture of data is something that's been missing. Right, I think that right now, if you ask a technologist, is it possible for me to combine pieces of information, their answer is going to be yes. Regardless of what platform, they can build it. The ethical question is really, should you, and is it really defining? So there are certain attributes of your financial history that you want to be kept absolutely, you know, sacrosanct. And that includes, you know, your bank accounts and all this other information. But the fact that you bought an asset at one point in your history, as it ages, it becomes less and less relevant. When you start taking a look at, and we've done some internal looks at information where we can, to the zip code kind of concept, identify where assets are more heavily held. The ethical barrier that we continually have to go through and check ourselves against is if the population of that specific zip code is under a certain amount, it's pretty easy for somebody to identify, you know, who's the big IBM owner or who's the big TIBCO owner or whatever else it might be. So you start generalizing it and you extend it up, you know, from the 10, actually you extend it to the 5-digit zip code, and then you start going to a general county level and so on. Sooner or later, you've gone through so many gyrations to anonymize the information that the information is, it's nice, but it's not really actionable at that point. I do think that the business needs to understand it as well as the regulators need to understand it, and they look at it in a very myopic view, in my opinion, at this time. And that myopic view, they put another regulation to cover a hole in the prior one. And every regulation is viewed by the older IT folks as a brand new data feed, a brand new set of infrastructure. And to your point of globalization, when we start talking about data sovereignty, I don't think that there is a company besides somebody like Amazon or Google who can afford to put infrastructure in every country that's got a sovereignty issue. So, you know, when you start breaking the mold of a traditional data center that a bank has or a, you know, a utility has, they're starting to look at the cloud because the cloud has availability zones and it has the ability to do it faster, better, and cheaper. You put all those factors in place and there is an initial skepticism as to what am I giving up if I put it out there? Data encryption, multi-level encryption, the penalty of encryption on latency. There's a lot of things that from an architecture perspective, if you were to start it today, you could build a much better system than if you had 50 years of legacy applications that have already monetized themselves and there's a business reality to not re-architecting them. So it's kind of a, you know, double.
Well, I come back to the point that was made earlier that I think architecturally, ultimately, we need to give the consumer the decision and allow them to make the decision on what and where data may or may not be shared, because I see regulations as it doesn't scale, right?
I mean, contemplate.
You can't do that. And it's interesting, you know, you have the privacy discussion. We did a pilot a few years ago called ICU.com, and it was kind of like a YouTube for healthcare, and